brought to you by Satanic International Network. You're listening to The Ooze.
I'm on the stage, every foul wicked spirit is the host, The Ooze.
20 minutes, Dead or Live, on The Ooze, right now.
On The Ooze, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
To really tap into the adversarial current
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now onto our show.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'm TC Downey, and you're listening to The Ooze. Saturday night, 11 p.m. Once again, I get to spend a full hour talking to myself just for you folks. A couple of things I wanted to kind of tap down on here real quick. I suppose the first thing that I really wanted to make mention of is that I'm not necessarily discouraged by this full hour of talking to myself. It's not something that I dread to do. It is difficult for me. But I consider it to be kind of a way to continue to challenge myself. I figure if once a week I can make it through a full hour of talking about this stuff without, great minds like Jason Sorrell or Dan Dredd or, Dark Fool, backing me up, then I guess that means that I'm making progress, because it's difficult for most people to stay on the same subject for 5 seconds, let alone a full hour. And I don't know if you guys have ever really been aware of how conversations actually happen, but they tend not to stay real focused either, unless it's something of great importance. So it's quite difficult. But anyway, there's a few things I wanted to point out. This week on eminentmind.info, there has been some incredible posting going on. It started off with some great posts from my good friend Messiah Bay. He put up some really good stuff. Jason Sorrell followed it with a knockout punch as he outlined the first stage of his exit plan as the Sly Man. And then to top it off today, Apsara Kamali, if I could say that shit correctly for once in my damn life, she put up probably one of the most concise posts I've read in a very long time. Incredibly creative and shows an extreme depth of understanding. You can tell she's really been doing the work. And that's something that you don't see very much from people who claim to practice the fourth way. Now, again, eminentmind.info. If you haven't checked it out yet, you certainly should check it out. It's nice to see that, my biggest fans are hanging in there, listening to me ramble on or whatever. But, here's the thing. Tonight's show is kind of inspired by, a lot of things that I've heard on the internet lately, particularly something I was listening to last night, and the person in this particular interview is a self-proposed fourth way master / guru. This person has offered, life coaching courses and all kinds of other crap. And I just couldn't believe the level of negligence in the discussion that happened last night, and I just kind of had to address a few of the points. And so I thought I would do that tonight by Going back over some of the highlights of it, and I'm not really going to tell you what was exchanged, but rather I'm just going to give you the correct information. I don't want to give any more attention to particular people than is necessary. But the first thing that I wanted to point out, if you really truly practice the fourth way, the first thing that you figure out after reading Gurdjieff is that there is no master. There is no student. Well, I shouldn't say that. There is only the student. There is only the student. The student learns on different levels. And sometimes the student knows a little more than students in the classes below them. Sometimes the student knows a little less than students above them. But there's only the student. Life is one big learning exercise. And if we can't all agree upon this, then I don't know what to say for the rest of you folks, because I'm absolutely certain that the object of experience is to learn. So, needless to say, you know, actually, let me deal with something real quick, because there's a little commentary going on. Talking, the bag talk, the bag discussion that I was giving at the beginning of this show was simply to give a point of reference for what inspired the show. And so, you got a problem with that? That's good. That's fine. That just simply means that you don't understand that things have to have a beginning. And that's okay. All right. Anyhow, needless to say, let me get started. The way that I'm going to get started tonight is I'm going to talk about something that is not very widely covered in the circles that I travel in. Now, I'm not saying that there's not some extensive work actually done on this in other circles that actually study this all the same. But it's not something that is often discussed. I mean, the fourth way, for that matter, is very rarely discussed. So, the development of a soul. Now, one of the things that I've heard going around is this idea that men were born without souls. That is not necessarily the case in Gurdjieff's teachings, especially in the last bit, the last book, which is entitled Life is Real Only When I Am. This book is Gurdjieff's final piece. He, at the very beginning of it, goes through and makes mention that a lot of his work previous to that, well, actually, he says all of his work previous to that, with the exception of his first piece, the Bezobov's Tales to His Grandson, was an error. And so he starts off saying, I'm sorry, I've given out the wrong information. What I want to do is I'm going to read a small bit from Gurdjieff's book. And in this, we should hopefully develop an understanding of what a soul actually is. So, again, this is from the book entitled Life is Only Real When I Am. And let me go ahead and I'm just going to read a little bit. What they call the soul does not really exist. But not everybody necessarily has one. Wait a minute. Did I say does not? Because if I did, that's an error on my part. What they call the soul does really exist. But not everybody necessarily has one. A soul is not born with man and can neither unfold nor take form in him so long as his body is not fully developed. It is a luxury that can only appear and attain completion in the period of responsible age, that is to say, in man's maturity. The soul, like the physical body, is also matter, only it consists of finer matter. The matter from which the soul is formed and from which it later nourishes and perfects itself is, in general, elaborated during the processes that take place between two essential forces upon which the entire universe is founded. The matter in which the soul is coded can be produced exclusively by the actions of these two forces, which are called good and evil by ancient science, or affirmation and negation. In contemporary science, they are called attraction and repulsion. In the common presence of man, these two forces have their source in the two totalities of general psychic functioning. All right, let me skip to the next page here, which has already been mentioned. One of them coincides with that function whose factors proceed from the results of impressions received from the outside, and the other appears as a function whose factor factors issues chiefly from the results of the specific functioning of the organs as determined by heredity. Right. In the common presence of a man, as in everything in the universe, sometimes one and sometimes the other of these totalities of functioning can serve as the source of one of the forces required for the process of which we are speaking. For this process, it is not important to know which of the two forces is affirmative and which is negative. What matters is that when one affirms, the other denies. Now, before I continue on, if you guys are hearing me stumble a little bit, it's because this copy of the book has typos in it, which I'm not really certain how they slipped through, but I guess everything has those problems. But anyway, the full realization and precise determination in man of that totality of functioning, whose factors are constituted from impressions coming from outside, is called the outer world of man. And the full realization of the other totality, whose factors have arisen from automatically flowing experiences and from reflexes of the organism, notably those organs whose specific character is transmitted by heredity, is called the inner world of man. In relation to these two worlds, man appears in reality to be merely a slave, because his various perceptions and manifestations cannot be other than conformable to the quality and nature of the factors making up these totalities. He is obliged, in relation to his outer world as well as his inner world, to manifest himself in accordance with the orders received from any given factor of one or the other totality. He cannot have his own initiative. He is not free to want or not to want. He is not free to want or not to want, but is obliged to carry out passively this or that result, proceeding from outer or inner results. Such a man, that is to say, a man who is related to only two worlds, can never do anything. On the contrary, everything is done through him. In everything, he is but a blind instrument of the caprices of his outer and inner world. The highest esoteric science calls such a man in quotation marks. In other words, he is named a man at the same time he is not a man. He is not a man such as he should be, because his perceptions and his manifestations do not flow according to his own initiative, but take place either under the influence of accidental causes or in accordance with functioning that conforms to the laws of two worlds, his inner world and his outer world. Now, I'm going to kind of stop reading right here and just talk a little bit about what we've actually got going on. All right. What we actually have going on here is Gurdjieff is saying that a man who is born without a soul is completely subjective to his inner world and his outer world, meaning the things that go on outside of him and the things that go on inside of him rule him. He does not consciously choose whether or not to act upon these things. Now, I know this vaguely sounds familiar. For those of you that hang around me and read my writing and are pretty familiar with me, I'm sure you're quite aware that this is something that is talked about quite a bit. So a soul is the sense of self and its maturity and ability to negate what influences it falls under. In other words, your soul is a complete you. It is not some mystical thing that animates you. Well, it does, and I hate to say it that way, but it's not some mojo jojo fucking, and excuse my friends, but it's not some mojo jojo, I don't know, specter style presence that's inside of you, or even if it was, it doesn't really matter. But what's important here is the soul is a man, or what's inside of a man that has a full conscious ability to negate what he is dealing with. He lives deliberately. It is a deliberate living inside of yourself. And I know this sounds kind of like difficult to wrap your mind around, but I'm not sure. Blah, 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 blah. The soul is what you are made up of. It is that thing that animates you. It is the thinker, the observer. The thing that we refer to as I. That is your soul. Now, this is important because of the next part, and that is the misunderstanding of the ray of creation. The ray of creation is absolutely, well, not necessarily some mythical hierarchy, but it's meant to demonstrate the interlocking between different levels of thinking. At the bottom, you have the absolute, you have the microbe, you have the most definite. It is the positive or the affirmation, as was just stated. At the top of it, you have the absolute also, only it is completely without definition. It is the totality of all. It is everything on the grandest scale. Now, they're two completely opposites. One's negative, one's positive, one's white, one's black. They're the polar extremes, and between them lies 7 points. These 7 points are allegorically represented in being the universe, the galaxy, the solar system, the universe, the galaxy, the macrocosm, the solar system, the earth, and the moon, or man. Now, the reason that the moon is chosen, the way that Gurdjieff taught, the moon was a newly forming sun. It would be the beginning stages of what would soon become a sun. He saw that the moon moved to the earth and became the earth. It became a living thing, and then it became completely energized, or blah, 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 blah. I'm trying to think of what the word is for it. I'm trying to think of what I want to say. it's completely intensified. It is what's actually happening. I mean, if you really look at things, and I'm just saying this from a certain sort of a speculative point. If you think about the moon, there's nothing living on it. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing there. It is new. It's just mass and space. And then you think about the Earth. Everything's alive. Everything is getting warmer. It's getting more active. It's becoming more, I don't know, it's more energized. And then you look at the sun, it is the totality of energy. The sun is pure energy. It's constant movement. It's constant outward thrust. It's constant push. It forces things to rotate around it. So these stages were representative or symbolic of different levels of thinking. These levels of thinking, these levels of thinking are all interconnected in one way or the other. Like, for instance, you can learn a lot, you know, by looking at things that go on around you and then seeing a correlation that happens on a microbic level, on the level of an atom. You know, you can look at directly at the way that the solar system works and the fact that the moon orbits the Earth orbits the sun, the entire solar system's in motion all the time. Then you can go down to the atom and you can see the, you know, the neurons and the protons and the electrons all doing their same thing. There is a figurative correlation at the very least. So the ray of creation was a way of thinking, a way of realizing that everything in some way or another is interrelated. I'm sorry, I had to take a drink of tea 20 minutes in, and I'm not as good at this as Jason Sorrell. I mean, if you all really want to hear somebody kick off for a good hour, just check out the Luminous Edition every Tuesday night. It's absolutely amazing, but enough patting Jason on the back and getting my nose brown. We all know he's smart. But anyway, the ray of creation is not some, I don't know, mystical hierarchy of things. It is an expression of, what the hell is the word? Allegorical understanding. And it is meant to explain things in a sense that one thing relates to the other, and no matter what, everything is all interconnected. It is to keep us focused on the fact that everything that we do, every choice that we make, everything that happens around us, everything that happens inside of us, it all has an effect. You guys have all heard about the butterfly effect. You know, the idea that if a butterfly flaps its wings, an earthquake happens in Japan, that kind of connection exists. It's obvious that it exists. You know, you throw a firecracker down a well somewhere and you might trip a fault line or something. It's just, you know, the environment is sensitive and it reacts. And sometimes we can see the manifestation of the reactions and other times we cannot. But they're there and it reacts. So that's the ray of creation. We've dealt a little bit with the soul. Now, the next thing that I really wanted to kind of talk about was the idea of identification, because I believe that certain fourth wave students consider identification to always being a negative thing. And that is not the case at all. In fact, it's only negative when it happens automatically. It is only negative when you do not consciously make the choice to identify with something. You cannot negate through life and accomplish any kind of goals or do anything without some form of identification happening. You would either automatically choose your identification or you are chosen for. Now, what is identifying? How does it happen? When we see a man smoking a cigarette, and we're a cigarette smoker, well, we identify with them immediately. We have this empathy that happens. And that empathy gives us the ability to put ourselves mentally into whatever situation we're going into. But it happens on even more levels than this, and I'm really just trying to kind of brush on all this stuff. And no, Jason, you're not fucking me up, dude. I'm just trying to wrap my thoughts around what I wanted to say. I went a little quicker through the reading on Gurdjieff than what I thought I was going to. So I'm like thinking to myself what other things I wanted to deal with. I'm not like you, dude. I can't make a list of points to deal with. If I do that, fuck it. It sounds robotic. It's just a nightmare. So, you know, I'm always shooting from the hip in a way. So identification, it's not a negative thing. You identify with everything all the time. You consider everything all the time. And when we talk about considering, what we mean by considering is a fairly simple thing. When you empathize, when you are able to allow it to have influence over you, that is considering. In its most basic form, it is to actually empathize. I mean, I really can't think of a better way to describe it than that. And I'm sure if I screw up too bad here, Jason, you're welcome to call in and tell me what an idiot I am. But I'm pretty sure that I've got this down right. So, you know, just touching on these terms right here, because I've seen a lot of stuff being posted out there that's just total horseshit. It's just not, absolutely not what has been taught. One of the things that I'm actually starting to scratch my head and figure out if there's really a solid relation to is this Enneagram of Personality. Oscar Achozo, if I said that right, I'm not looking at his name or anything, He was a student of Gurdjieff's, and he came up with these nine categories. And it's interesting that he places the names that he places in the positions that he places them in. Because if you line them right up with the ray of creation, I'm just going to go ahead real quick and pop up. And all this stuff's Enneagram talk, in case anybody who's listening doesn't know. The Wikipedia's got a decent article on the Enneagram. The Array of Creation article, in my opinion, is flawed. So if you want to learn about the Array of Creation, I would recommend reading, I think it's chapter 14 of In Search of the Miraculous by P.D. Ouspensky. They line things up poorly and don't explain it very well, but the rest of the information that's there is pretty solid, so you know, you might want to go ahead and check that out. But I'm going to go ahead and kind of tell you about this Enneagram personality, because each Enneagram interrelates in one way or the other. So let's start off with the first point, the reformer. That's the first one. Now, this would coincide with the microbe world. The informer would coincide with the microbe world. And I'm not really sure how the two of them connect together, except for the act of reforming is the act of getting things in order. It's the act of right action. It's pure mechanical behavior. So maybe that's where it lines up. I mean, this is one of the flaws that I see in it. Number two would be the helper. Now, the helper coincides with man or the moon. It's somebody who's acting either intentionally or unintentionally to move along through the flow of things. I mean, life is in a constant motion. It's not something that sets still ever. Even on the quietest nights, you can hear the crickets chirping in the background. So, again, the helper, I'm not really sure how that works there, except for that maybe the connection's altruism. I'm not really sure about that. Number three is the achiever. Number three correlates with Earth. Now, interestingly enough, if you line up the Enneagram of consciousness as I've outlined it on eminentmind.info, you'll find that this is the point in which it lines with energy or with activity. So the correlation, you know, the Earth's constantly moving, it's constantly going, it's achieving. On this level, you can, come to a certain set of truisms. Blah, blah, blah. Putting my cigarette out, don't mind me. So, number four, the individualist. Now, the individualist lines up perfectly with, actually, number three should have been energy. So number four lines up with the world then, which, yeah, would be the solar system, or all planets as they've got it on in the ray of creation. And so, again, I don't really see where these two things line up, except for when you get down to number eight, and which is universe. And that is the challenger. And in that, I'm not really even certain that there's a lineup there. So, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, all right. So that's really, the only bit I had tonight on the fourth way is just those couple of little things. I welcome any callers at this point to call in, challenge my ideas, 347-989-1371. If you know something about the Enneagram of personality, and you can explain to me how it connects to the ray of creation, how it connects to what Gurdjieff outlined, I'd be happy to hear it, because I just don't really see the connection between the two. Let me see. I'm trying to think of what I'm wondering here real quick, and I'm going to ask the people in the chat room this, but do you guys seem to reach a point of not being able to hear? One of the things I've noticed in listening to Blog Talk Radio shows when I am not the host is that you'll be going through the show, and all of a sudden the sound just quits. Everything stops. It's just standing still, and you have to reload the page to get it to work. So I'm just curious, because I've always noticed that people are constantly logging in and logging out in the chat room, and I just thought maybe it was bad internet connection on their part. But my experience recently, having gone to listen to a couple of other shows, is that this is what's happening on a constant basis. So, all right, blah, blah, blah. I'm just curious. 26 minutes left. Boy, I blew my nut fast. Thank God that doesn't transfer into every other point in life here. Well, maybe it does, but just kind of was curious. I'm constantly seeing people log in and log out, how that goes. Yeah, I'm out of shit to say, so call on in, guys. No, no bites. All right. So I thought I would take a minute and, I don't know, I wanted to discuss the idea of relevance. The thing about relevance, in my mind, is that it's a completely subjective thing, where one person can think something's relevant because it's something that they're interested in, or it's a direction that they want to go. I just want to throw out to Tim is Hardcore, bite me. Relevance is only really important when it is in congruence with, I don't know, whatever point you're negating, whatever you're looking at. I think it's funny when people talk about whether, you know, somebody's relevant or not. I'm just kind of blown away by it usually. Let's see, here we go. What's up, dude?
What's going on, man?
Not a lot. I'm just sitting here drowning, going, holy shit, man, I went through that way too fast. I mean, I was thinking about going back and reading more, and I was like, nah, because the next section's like probably about 10 pages before you reach any kind of real conclusive point to it, and that's a lot of reading, so...
Well, let's talk real quick about what you got going on there with the first part there, where Gurge is talking about a soul and how a man lacks a soul, and it's not until he's developed fully in his physical sense, his physical self, his mental self, before he can actually have that level of development. It's my opinion that you could use the analogy of childhood. That when a baby's born, when a child is walking around learning whatever to do, its whole world as a child, your whole world is defined by your parents. Your whole world is defined by your outside influences, what you got going on. And while you're trying to deal with all these outside influences, don't touch your neighbor, don't pull on your hair, stop playing with your shirt, pushing your chair, all that outside influence stuff. On the other side, you've got all these urges, all these things you want to do. All these things that you know, you want to touch things, you want to do things. You got all these little crazy things going on, all these urges. And at some point in your growth, in your physical growth, you mature, in your social growth, in your mental growth, you mature to a point where you know the rules, you know the parameters, you know what you fall under and don't fall under. Now, and this is true of especially a lot of ancient cultures, basically, where that level of maturity, that level of understanding what was expected of you in society, what was expected of you as a fully grown human being, that was all taught to you. But at some point, you had to join the tribe not as a man or a woman defined by those influences, defined by your training, but as a distinct individual who brought something of yourself to the game, who brought something more real to what was going on. So I think when Gurdjieff talks about developing that soul, he's talking about a level of maturity and awareness, where before, everything you had going on was, again, defined by outside influences and internal urges, what you were talking about earlier, what he was talking about. You're this thing that's drawn between these two points of a string. You're this knot that's unraveling, basically. You're going one way with the influences and the other way with the urges. When you have a mature awareness, that's when you can go ahead and limit the pull from both ends and pull yourself in a different direction. And that ability to pull yourself, that ability to be self-determining, that's the root of a soul. And it's the development of that self-determination that results in a soul and results in that development.
I would agree with that. I was actually prior to the show, I had developed this analogy that I was going to use, but I wasn't sure if I could express the idea behind it. But when we talk about, like, soul music, one of the things that really sticks out to me about soul music is that each thing that's in play in that particular song carries its own note. It holds itself in a way that it's distinguishable by your ear. It's formed its own character. It has its own presence. And that, I think now that you kind of lined that out and we've wrapped up, talking about it, reading that little chapter there, and we now, I think that it now would fit better and people could understand it.
Mm-hmm. And it is. It's that level of distinctiveness. It's that people talk about Gurdjieff when he would walk through a room, when he would walk around, that he walked through life not being touched by it. And that's, it's far out there. It's a sign of an awareness that is fully developed. It's a sign of a person who is not identifying with everything he engages in and not considering all those things he encounters. He's able to make sure that internally he remains consistent. Internally he remains self-determined, self-guided. And just like you're saying, it's a soul music. Gurdjieff had this, at least amongst it. And this is, again, all the information we have on Gurdjieff, what we study, comes from his supporters, comes from people who admired him. So, of course, it's all going to be glowing and positive for the most part. But the impression these people had was that he existed in a manner that reality didn't touch him. He was aware of it. He was engaged in it, but he was still distinct from it. And that's the kind of thing I think that Gurdjieff is encouraging all of us to develop.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. You don't even need to read any of the biographies or books about lessons and stuff that people who studied under him learned from. If you just picked up his first or his third book that he published himself and read through it, the miraculous separation between his writing and what's known conventionally, it stands on its own 2 feet in a completely different way. As a matter of fact, in the beginning of Bezobalb's Tales to His Grandson, he actually talks about the fact that he's intentionally not going to write in a conventional style for the simple fact that he wants it to stand apart. He wants you to have to come to realize that you're dealing with somebody who is separate yet fully engaged. And that, I think that's the part that people don't really get, is that he's still completely engaged in reality, but he's separate in that he chooses where to move.
All right. He chooses to be a distinct component of that reality. He's just a cog. He's just not a background color in a painting. He's not he's not just another piece of the machine or the system. He's not another employee in a cubicle. He's not another guy playing a video game. Everything he does, everything he did, he strove to do intentionally, strove to do with as much awareness, as much awareness of self and awareness of what was going on around him as possible. And for myself, I would say that Gurdjieff, is no more perfect than the rest of us. Had no more potential than anybody out there. It's just that what he did with such intent, with such practice, with such effort, that later in his later years, he became, that definition of the act. I mean, we watched, let's say, baseball players, throwing a pitch. They make it look easy. Well, yeah, of course they make it look easy because they've been doing it for years. And that's the kind of thing that it takes. The route of the sly man is easier in many ways than any other paths to enlightenment, but it's still difficult. It still takes a long, long time and requires that kind of effort and dedication.
Right. See, I don't necessarily think that the route of the sly man is in any sense easier. In fact, I think it's more difficult, but it produces more results. The three traditional paths prior to that, you only focused on one aspect of yourself, and what you ended up with was a non-equilateral triangle. You would be overdeveloped mentally, but underdeveloped physically and emotionally, and
right.
And the other three ways alike. But the idea with the Sly Man was to develop all of you at once in unison, to force yourself to grow, and not to just grow in one direction, but to grow all the way. So in that sense, it's not easier by any stretch of the imagination. It's just the results are real in comparison.
Right. And I think also it's a relative matter, you know, it's a matter of perspective as far as, you know, I say easier because you do get those results. It is a little bit more concrete. So in my mind, you know, since you have those results, since you have that verification, it seems simpler to me to understand.
Sure.
But yeah, when you're talking about a physical adept, a martial artist or whatever, who's, you know, practicing his martial art as, you know, as a philosophy, as a way of life, at the end of the day, he may achieve enlightenment based on his relative perspective on what enlightenment should be through his martial arts. But a monk, let's say, in a monastery is going to disagree. He's going to look at a man who lived his life by war and never knew enlightenment. A guru, somebody you know who's an intellectual, an academic, is going to look at the physical adept and see a barbarian, see a monster. And each are going to have that same look. And it's the Sly Man, the path that Gurdjieff laid out, the work that he suggested, where you seek a balance, just like you were saying, and you try to achieve enlightenment on all levels, on all fronts, so that you're able to understand and comprehend all these things. And hopefully through that effort, you know, you're able to do more.
Right on, man. So I guess the next thing I really wanted to kind of ask you about, identification. Do you have a better way of explaining it than what I did?
Well, identification, from my understanding, is when you're engaged in a task, whatever it is, and in the process of being engaged in that task, your awareness becomes the task you're engaged in, and you cease to be yourself. So if you're watching television, become identified with the show, and that's the purpose of movies and television, is to get you to identify so much with the show that your sense of self is lost. Whatever goals, whatever aspirations you had, they disappear while you're watching the show. While you're doing your work, your sense of self disappears. With consideration, with external consideration, because internal consideration, and this is based on my understanding of the writing, is a positive thing. External consideration is when you let those things around you that you encounter change you internally. Like, let's say you're walking down the street and, you're just bebopping along. You're wearing the same clothes you always wear and whatever. You know, I know what you look like. You know what we look like. You know, we're not, you know, we're not those handsome guys walking down the street or whatever, and we don't necessarily dress to the nines and want to look good when we go out and stuff. I mean, that's just the way it is. So if you see some woman walking down the street and she scowls at you because you're wearing whatever T-shirt you're wearing or whatever, external consideration would be taking that scowl and instead of ignoring it, not even letting it affect you, you know, that's, oh, her face made an interesting kind of expression. You internalize it. You go, what was that bitch's problem? And what's her thing? And what's wrong with me? Why is she looking at me and giving me that kind of shit? It changes you internally. So you're not consistent. You're just the result of whatever you is. You're the result of whatever reflection of shit you deal with outside of yourself.
Right on. Well, something I'd like to say, and it's not necessarily intended to contrast what you were saying, but
sure.
My beliefs are that both external and internal consideration can both be haphazardous or dangerous if they're not done with intentionality. You know, like to allow myself to be influenced by something that, like say for instance, I wanted to be a tattoo artist, to allow myself to be influenced in my, you know, in tattooing by somebody who's a great tattoo artist, that's not a bad thing. It's when I'm not intentionally doing that and I'm allowing his behaviors and other stuff to rub off on me. If all I'm trying to do is pick up his good habits and how he performs the work that he's doing, then it's not a bad thing. But when you're picking up all of the other external stimuli as well and doing it unintentionally, that's when it becomes a negative point. And it could be said the same about yourself if you are considering internally, if you're identifying with that feeling of frustration you're getting because, you know, the bitch across the counter is, counting the change wrong, or she's giving you the wrong change, or she can't seem to operate her cash register right. If you identify with that frustration and allow it to come out and act for you in place of you automatically, that's a negative thing. But, if you take into consideration that you're feeling this way and you can choose whether or not to act upon it, then at that point, good results can be born from it. So,
right, and that's where,
please.
That's where we all start, I think. I'm having this emotion, I'm having this feeling, and it's wasteful. I'm having this feeling, and I shouldn't be having it. That's where we all have to start. That's the beginning. It's the ability that I think that where the feeling doesn't even arise because you don't allow yourself to even have it. You don't even need it. That kind of thing. That's the goal.
Right.
And I guess with the external consideration, you can fall under certain influences if you're aware. If you select those influences, like you're saying, if you're taking the advice of a great tattoo artist and letting his opinion hone and shape your goals, and that kind of consideration is necessary. But if you let the guy, if you're learning to do tattoo art, that's a physical process and an intellectual process. It's when you take whatever he says. If he says you're making a mistake, and you get emotional about it, okay, that's external consideration gone wrong. And I guess as far as the internal consideration, now I guess I'm thinking about it, because we know some prime examples of this kind of thing. When you are so engaged, so wrapped up in what it is you're thinking, what it is you believe, where you detach from reality in that way, kind of narcissism or refusal to see that maybe you're wrong about something, that there might be ideas or understandings that are better than yours, even though you've been working at this longer than they have, whatever, that kind of thing, that unwillingness to recognize that you can learn from people who have less experience because they bring new ideas as much as you can learn from people who have more experience. And when you get to a point where you don't think there's anybody left for you to learn from, that's internal consideration taken to a dangerous level.
Right. Matter of fact, that kind of reinforces what I opened the show up with, which is the fact that there are no masters. There are only students. And, and each student can learn from, a student on a lower level or a student on a level above them or a student on the same level as them. They can learn from them. And when you take the absolute, like you're saying, and you say, no one can do this better than me. I'm the best at that. Well, that's when you've stopped growing. You've grown stagnant, and you'll see that in whatever it is that you're trying to produce. If you're trying to start this, psycho fucking Green Lantern worshiping religion, and you say, I am the ultimate master, I know everything about the Green Lantern, you are inevitably going to stifle yourself out. You'll end up with you'll end up with a forum with about six people posting on it. You'll end up with a church with about three people in the pews. It doesn't matter what direction you're going there. The point is that when you take the stance as being the ultimate authority, you stop growing.
Right. Well, when you reach a point in your mind where you can't allow yourself to be wrong, you learn from your mistakes. When you can't allow yourself to have a mistake and learn from it, well, then your growth ceases.
Absolutely. And so I thought this whole show would be kind of cool. There hasn't been much discussion on what a soul is. I've talked a lot about the idea of spirit, and the things are completely different. And I think that because they're both abstract in their understanding that people often will confuse them and mix them together, but that they are separate things. You know, spirit is in fact the act of being completely identified with something, as far as I can tell.
Sure.
And soul, on the other hand, is the thing that chooses whether or not to identify.
Right. And it's not, and you know, Gurdjieff describes it as a material component, you know, to make sure it's distinct. It's not metaphysical. It's not mystical, the soul. It's a component of the self that, again, distinguishes itself from the reality that it's embedded in.
Right. Right. It distinguishes itself in a way that it's measurable to an extent. And I think that that's a very important point there, because I do believe you can measure how much soul a person has. One example I might think of someone who had a very well-developed soul might be Bruce Lee. You know, we all know he was a fabulous martial artist, but if you ever got a chance to sit down and look at some of the philosophies that he talked about and the way that he talked about those, you would find that he was very well-developed in that aspect, too. So...
I don't know. I'd agree with that totally. It's an excellent example.
So that's one that I thought I would point out there. That here's a man that has developed his soul. Another one that I might point out, and actually it's kind of funny that it's of Eastern origin as well, would be Sun Tzu. You know, he was very, very well developed in every category, an excellent warrior, an excellent strategist, and an excellent philosopher, and I don't think that most people realize that philosophy, in fact, is the logical process of dealing with feeling, or at least as I understand it. You know, you can have a philosophy for everything because you're dealing with how you're going at it, but in particular, how you're going at it emotionally. And I know that may sound a little bit crazy to some people, but emotions aren't necessarily happy, sad, you know, mad, glad. Emotion is that thing that we're still trying to all figure out exactly how to talk about, the soul.
Hmm. And it's why this expression of the soul, the development of the soul, doesn't necessarily mean greatness. It doesn't necessarily mean fame either. There, I'm sure, are housewives who have fully developed souls, who are dedicated to the purpose of being a housewife, who, you know, whatever they do, they pursue it totally with everything they have, but are distinct and aware of themselves and just have defined themselves in that manner. So, the examples that stick out are the ones that have done something of significance historically. But doing something significant is not necessarily an earmark of having a soul.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's something, since we got about 2 minutes left, that's something I really wanted to kind of tap on, too, because I think that success is measured not by other people's putting merit on it, but by your own merit of it, if that makes any clear sense at all. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, you can be completely developed, your soul developed, and not seek outward recognition. As a matter of fact, it's not about seeking outward recognition. It's about accomplishing what you wanted to accomplish.
Right. It falls back to that maturity of awareness, that the idea that you have become distinct from your environment. It doesn't matter what other people think. It doesn't matter what, you know, what accolades they're going to throw upon you or what derision they throw upon you. It's you are satisfied with what it is you're pursuing, that you know that you're doing well.
Right on. But Jace, we got just about a minute left, man. If you would hit me up after the show, actually, I kind of wanted to just touch base with you a little bit. So,
all right, right on. All right. We'll do.
Sounds good. Everybody, check us out tomorrow night as we go into part 3 of Take Action.
Right on, man. Later.
Thank you for listening to the Ubers. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but it's the old expression goes. Tough luck. Special thanks to Dad, Rocky DeRoma, for his contribution to this outro. The Ubers is the Creative Oddity Studios product. Revolution is presented by Satanic International Network as its official Blog Talk Radio show. Why waste your time with those other guys?